if you turn on the channel, everything looks the same. You know, not the same, but it's like it's all close-ups, medium shots, long shots. You know, sort of the grammar of film is pretty similar. But it seems like magic because you don't realize. And once you understand, oh, that's how they construct a shot, that's how you tell a story visually, it becomes really easy. And, you know, that's why I've sort of spent my life trying to figure out how to make sure that people in conflict areas, people in developing countries can learn that and can compete with sort of international news. You know, we don't say, oh, well, the only guy who can do it is Anderson Cooper and his, like, CNN TV team, right? But yet, even today, we're seeing so many videos coming out of Syria that don't tell us a story, right? We have a large amount of awareness about what's happening in Syria, but we have very little understanding. And we need local people. We need the local context that Sabrina's talking about.
Great. Awesome. Where can people find the manuals? Are they?
Oh, yeah. So that's smallworldnews.com or smallworlds.tv/guide.
Guide. Smallworldnews.tv/guide. You can find these resources and use them. I just want to wrap up amazing mentions. We've got camel toe, donkeys as a technology, and the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Do you guys know, remember Fantasia? Do you know what we're talking about with the brooms? And Mickey just wanted to like have some help cleaning up, and it just all went crazy. So that's what we're talking about here. Well done. Well done, my friends. So we're going to kick off a little bit of Q&A. We've got lots of time for your questions. I've picked up a few. Good morning. I picked up a few questions from the hashtag. So if you're too shy to ask, you can feel free to use the hashtag on Twitter, and I will ask your questions for you, and I will use your first name unless you tell me not to. As you're getting ready for questions, we are going to have a handheld mic, and people will come to you, so don't ask your question until the mic gets to you. I'm going to kick some things off here to get right into it. For me, there's a great project launched by a woman, Katrine Verklaas of mobileactive.org, which is a great organization if you're looking for global context around mobile technologies. And she launched a project called Failfair. And that was learning from each other's failures. What has just blown up miserably, or even not so miserably, but what can we learn from that so that we don't keep repeating the same mistakes? Because that's often one of my frustrations, especially from that kind of paternal, we're going to go save the world, and we don't actually know any of the history that came before us. So I'd love to hear from each of you what some of your favorite, most spectacular technology failures were and what people can learn from them going forward. Go ahead.
All right. I'm psyched to talk fail. So hashtag fail path. I think, yeah, uploading your entire contact list to their server without them telling you is an epic fail. And people freaked out, understandably, because they don't know that their entire contact list is going to go up there. And that can't be a precedent that we set with technology. Again, I don't think that anybody that works at that company likes Tron or has that we fight for the users mentality when they're building their tech. And that's just a problem. If you look at Kazakhstan, their laws are that everything has to go onto a server in Kazakhstan. So now you picture any technology where, by default, all your information is going into one of their servers that they have complete access to. Okay, now they know your entire contact list and can start targeting people. We need that sort of transparency when we're building these tools. Otherwise, it's going to be bad for the business model. I'm curious if Path suddenly saw out of their spike of users a downgrade. I'm assuming that that is the case.
My, I guess, favorite fail, I don't know, my fail, I think, would be the image of woman with mobile phone, liberated, free, empowered, just because she has a mobile phone. And in the case of Somalia, there was this program called Somalia Speaks. It was a partnership between Al Jazeera and Ushahidi. And they built out this text program to Somalis asking them to share how the conflict's report has impacted their life. And the nuance of that is that, one, in Somalia, the telecommunications providers are corrupt. There's like a deep seeded mistrust in among Somalis of them, even though they were going through an NGO partner that partnered with the relief organizations and their provider was legit. And women in Somalia are incredibly illiterate. The illiteracy rate in Somalia is staggeringly high. It's 73% for women in Somalia. So if I send you a text message asking, how's your life going? You can't read it. You can't respond to it. And there's kind of like this ideological bias, especially in the journalism space, towards the written word that is not... it's not going to be successful on the ground in Somalia, especially in a society that places so much value on spoken word, on speech, on person to person. So,
yeah, great, Brian.
So,
epic fail.
What?
Epic fail.
Yeah. So, I bet probably most of you heard about what happened about 3 weeks ago in Syria. Two American journalists and a French journalist were killed in a sort of a rocket attack, and everybody went the news went haywire with this idea that, oh, they were all targeted by their sat phones and the Syrians were targeting journalists. And, you know, it's always bigger news when, you know, an American or a foreigner, or especially such a storied war correspondent, you know, gets killed. The reality is that, you know, Marie Colvin, just a few weeks before she was getting killed, was telling her friends, I'm not using my Thuraya phone because it's not safe, so instead I'm communicating over Skype. Well, if the technology is not magical to you, right, then you understand that Skype needs a satellite connection, right? It needs a sort of a 24/7 broadband connection to work. A satellite phone sends radio waves to a satellite in the sky when it's turned on and when you're making your phone call. A satellite modem sends radio waves to the sky all the time. They use the same portal to connect, right? So if your issue is being targeted or being located, you're much better off with a phone, even a Thuraya phone, which, you know, and we have the second magical thinking around this is that somehow Thuraya is really bad and totally insecure, but, you know, my Inmarsat phone is great. Well, we found about 1 week before, 2 weeks before Marie was killed, that some German researchers put out and showed that they could decrypt on the fly with about $3,000 of technology calls from Thuraya phones or from Inmarsat phones, right? So these are the things. We have to understand how the tech works so that mm-hmm. we can kind of figure out what's going on. And unfortunately, you know, the folks who've been sending satellite phones and satellite modems into Syria, they really wanted to help, and they weren't, you know, they weren't considering the ramifications of what they were doing, and they really deprioritized the sort of the training and the security aspect in favor of, we just have to get the images out. And, you know, I totally respect that, but luckily, now they've had this rude awakening, they're rethinking, you know, they're actually starting to talk to some of the people who were warning them a year ago of what the risks were of their process, you know, so it's unfortunate that it took the loss of many lives, but at least it's progress, right? And that's really the fail fair, right?
Progress.
So learning from our mistakes, which actually leads me to a question that's come up on the hashtag from Luke. He's curious as to kind of what app do you feel would have the greatest impact to empower the repressed and dictatorships? What should exist but doesn't yet? And in like pie in the sky, what kinds of things need to happen? Anyone? Big question.
I think it's really hard to say because I think one of the lessons from this panel is that each context is so specifically different. It's really hard to build tools that are going to be kind of the all-encompassing go-to. But it's about building the apps in a smart way that have redundancy, that have security standards, where all of that is built in so that people are taken care of. And certainly I think there are ways to start creating coding standards because hackers love their coding standards. You know, can there be something built into agile framework that has the coding for dictatorship methodology so that people are in that mindset and the Tron soundtrack can be playing while they're doing it? I think that could be a beautiful way to move forward.
Mm-hmm. I think people forget that people in these countries under hardship are people and that they have agency and that technology is a conduit to empowering that agency. And listening to that question, I'm I'm dreaming of an app that could help people tell their own stories in a way that is contextual to their lives. I don't really know what that looks like. We could have a hack session after, but and I'm sure there are tools that exist that just need to be mashed together, given you know the context of that person's life. But yeah, so.
Well, we're actually developing. It's in the concept stage right now, but we're basically trying to take our manual, and we're working with Nathan Freitas of Guardian Project. So the Guardian Project is basically a suite of apps that involve, you know, encrypted phone, encrypted text, all, you know, Tor. And then the part that we're bringing to it is how do we make it really simple for anybody to not only shoot video that's good on their phone, assemble that video, and make it able to be found, right? When you've got 80 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every 2 minutes, you know, you need to start thinking about at the point of production, how do you enable curation? And how do you do it in such a way that anybody now can make a video? Because, you know, Android phones are not widely available yet outside of the developed world, but it's going that way, yeah. Right? Even iPhones, even Nokia touchscreens, I mean,
And if you want to find out more about the Guardian Project, it's guardianproject.info, I think.
Yep.
And it's a really incredible project, especially always looking for, you know, people, the hacker coder contingent to get on board. And it's a fantastic project. So another another question actually that I had, and then I think we might move to asking you all to start talking to us, I've been thinking a lot about and listening to you guys talk about these tools and context and all the things, but how do you deal with the kind of the cat and mouse game of once you've figured out a way to maneuver around a certain restriction that's either, you know, coming from a government or coming from context, you know, and then the government in question finds out what you're doing. And goes, you know. So how do you help people manage that kind of cat and mouse game? Are there guidelines that you can say to people? Is it about the iterative process of development? How, some thoughts on that?
Part of it is just having examples of awesome. So I was in Kazakhstan lecturing with the Prime Minister, and they were like, okay, flash words, Facebook, Twitter, those things cause revolution. We need to cut it out. We need to shut it down. This is going to kill our citizens, right? Very different mentality from a more closed society. And I said, look, you know, there are examples of open governance in the U.S. where people are looking at their citizens as advisors, not as dissidents. And then these tools are actually being used for pretty awesome stuff. You know, it's lowering costs, it's increasing opportunity, it's actually contributing towards a better society rather than just this tear down, right? But the branding of Facebook and Twitter as a revolutionary tool is making this cat and mouse game a lot harder because the branding of these tools is really doing wonderful, socially good projects. It's just that message is not as out there.
I think you, Deanna, you answered the question for me that it's an iterative process.
And sorry about that.
Ferrantunde, actually, like his motto that change is constant, and installing a culture of change into the process of how an organization works, I think, is vital. And a lot of NGOs don't really adapt that, especially humanitarian NGOs.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that is cool that technologists and NGOs have in common is that they both come from a place of seeking solutions. And the one thing you should add when you are playing essentially a cat and mouse game is an element of iterative change, that change is constant, and accepting that sometimes things are going to fail and you're going to have to pivot.
Great.
Well, and I think it's honestly, you know, I think that people who are the local people who are in the conflict area are best able to figure out, you know, what's the process to keep themselves safe. However, they need the training to understand the basics of how the technology works, right? You know, I have technologists telling me that, well, you know, if you're not completely encrypted all the time, well, you know, you're just deserving to get, you know, just deserve to get killed, right? People literally say that. They're like, you're just stupid and you don't know what you're doing. You know, and we say, well, look, people have been using codes to communicate in Syria for years because they know their calls are being listened into. But, you know, once they figure out that their calls are being listened into, they can figure out a way around it, right? They're not going to find a hyper-encrypted you know, they're not going to have a crypto phone, which is a point-to-point encrypted cell phone, right? They're not going, we're not going to drop like 10,000 of those at $2,000 a piece. But if we can just learn, oh, well, I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to call Mark and say, hey, Mark, you know, my uncle came to visit today and we're going to our family reunion for a while. You know, and he knows that that means something else than my uncle, right?
That you're going to get ice cream.
Yeah, we're going to get ice cream. Exactly. You know, but it's like that's, you have to use codes that, that seem, you know, subliminal, right? But they know that. You know, they don't need to be taught that. They just need to understand the process of what are the risks that they're taking.
Right.
You know, and that's what technologists need to do more of. And, you know, that's why we try to sort of sit at that space between people who are, who need to, like, need answers and the people who are building the solutions, because a lot of these people don't have any idea what these people are saying. You know, they hear Chinese or, like, some weird dialect of something that's totally not English. You know, we're talking about high latency connections and SSL and,
you
know, it's like, what?
So let's go to you all. We've got microphones that are going to be running around, and I'm going to do the opposite of what most people. I'm going to start in the back to the person way in the back, and then we're going to come up and work our way forward, because the people in the back never get called on. Oh, wait, before you ask your question, I'm sorry. I always have to say this. If you're going to ask a question, think about it as a tweet, two sentences or less, because you always get those people in the panel that go on and on and on about their own project, and they're really just trying to promote the project, and then they'll be like, they'll ask the panel, and they'll be like, and what do you think of that? So we don't want to take away from anybody else's ability to ask questions and use up all that time. So two sentences or less, 140 characters. That's how you're going to ask us questions. All right. In the back.
Hi.
Oops.
Is this on?
I don't think it is. Try it again. He's fixing it. Try again.
Hello?
No.
I can just ask you like this.
Wow. Well, we have a... It's being recorded, and so we want to make sure that the recording... Get. So test, can we run another mic back to her? How about that? Can we get the other mic to go back to her, please?
Test, test, one, two. Test, test, test.
Can we make sure that one works?
Test, 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 test.
Can you mic check that, please?
Mic check.
Yay. Mic check.
Test, test, one, two.
Sometimes technology doesn't work.
Yeah. Nobody? All right, Sarah.
Nobody died.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Nobody died in the use of testing that mic.
All right, go ahead.
So I'm a journalist and technologist. I'm in New York. I work at Columbia Journalism School. And I have experience living in sub-Saharan Africa. But New York and technology, a lot of the places these are coming from, people don't have on-the-ground experience. The question is, do you have recommendations for resources about how we can inform ourselves, people who are web-oriented, about the kinds of tools and technologies beyond this panel that work in these environments?
Favorite tools and technologies?
Well,
and learning.
I love, like personally, I love finding the media of the community that I'm working in, and the preferred form of media, and obsessively listening and looking and consuming it, and then I get tools from that. Like, there are things that are mentioned. Radio is dominant in the Horn of Africa. Newspapers in Afghanistan, radio and television as well, but it's a mix. So in the Horn, I consume a ton of media, and I get like I go to Hiran.net, and I pull things that are being mentioned in those interviews, and there are always translations that are being shared too.
And with the questions, I think I'm going to have one panelist answer each question because we're starting to run out of time a little bit. I want to make sure everybody gets. But if there are other things that you guys want to contribute and recommend, maybe we can post it to the hashtag shortly after the session as a way to continue the conversation. Next question. Ron, right here.
I'm going to start by talking about my project. So I'm curious.
Who gives a shit?
Who gives a shit, right?
That's what his t-shirt says, by the way. I'm not
talking about
saying that.
Podcast.
140. So to what extent are the technology providers responsible, or like what is their role? So you sort of think what, you know, Twitter did in Egypt. It was pretty amazing. You think what Google Voice did. Like there are all these amazing roles that they can play. what happens when shit goes awry? Like, what is their responsibility to the folks on the ground?
Who wants to take that? How about the guy that was on the ground?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, well, real quick, you know, the speak to tweet thing was great, but actually we were involved, and this woman right here, Iman, was coordinating the translation. We crowdsourced translators to be able to actually take those tweets, archive them, index them, and make them accessible to everybody, right? And unfortunately, what it comes down to is that quite often these organizations, and I won't name one, but we were talking to people who basically said, we don't want to get involved in the politics. And that's just reality, right? Because if you want to do business in a country, you have to be very careful about what things you support. And I think they're learning, and you know, some of them are doing better than others. I mean, it was interesting that they put together the speak to tweet thing. I don't think they'd do that today. You know, I don't think they'd do that right now with SCAF running things, and you know, with the current Egyptian crisis. And in fact, Google decided to just turn off the Say Now. So you can't get any of that audio anymore because it was their sort of corporate process. They said, okay, well, that was a property that we purchased. We did this thing for a little while. Now we're moving on to roll it into our business. And, you know, they didn't have to ask anybody. So it was nice that they did that during the revolution. But then, you know, corporate sort of things dominate, right?
He's like, can I? Yes. And then we're going to take one more question. And then I have the big question that has been asked on Twitter, which I'm going to say for last because it's most interesting and you'll want to stay for it. Go ahead.
I mean, there's, and I hope I don't steal the question, but there was the question, you know, is the internet a human right? And I think that, yes, companies have to be value neutral to an extent, and you can't blame companies outright for not understanding a situation that's going to arise, but then they have to iterate once that situation does arise. The issue is that there is a set standard for what it means to be human and a set goal in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and making sure that our technologies are built to that standard and saying, look, our technology is value neutral based on these standards, is the way to address the concerns when a foreign government says, you know, you have to alter your technology to be this or that or to change it so that it's not secure. Well, international legal code does not allow for that. So, you know, it's not us, it's this international framework, and I'm sorry, but, you know, here's the standard that we're facing, and at least be transparent about it. I think Google's been really good at, you know, you can see what government's requesting, how much information from them.
Right. One more question from the audience, and then I'm going to ask one last one. Right here, then. Oh, sorry, was there a girl? Because we should make it more diverse.
Any ladies?
Any ladies want to ask a question before the dude does? Just kidding.
Ladies, go. Know everything.
Yes. All right. Dude, ask your question.
Yeah. Do you think there's a role for, like, a black hat version of this where you, you know, you tweet us an IP that's being used by a government to, you know, kill people, and we DDoS it?
Amen, brother.
Thugs don't tweet.
I didn't say that.
I mean, that's already happening. Anonymous has been really effective at doing this, saying, look, here's a government or here's an institution that's killing people or oppressing people. Let's all go there and attack. I think DDoS is difficult because it's silencing speech in many ways. You know, it's not working towards something better, but it's reprimanding people for something that's bad. I think it's had its place, but it's the creativity in tactics where you're always going to have to figure out something better. Because if you DDoS them, then they're just going to start DDoSing activist websites. And, like, that's going to be really unfortunate. And people can't have their own infrastructure where, you know, my friends in Georgia can't have a Georgian blog hosted in Georgia with technology that they've all built because it'll get DDoSed by the Russians and they'll be silenced. So then they have to use a framework that's from the U.S. and who knows what kind of complications there are because they don't know how secure or socially good that technology provider is, hosting provider, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we need a system of mutual support, right? We need to start looking at how do we work together to the goals that we have rather than how do we just say that's bad and we're going to stop it, you know, because there's always going to be another that's bad unless we're actually building the society that we want to see.
Last question, and then we're actually over time a little bit. Is from the tweet is a more direct thing that I think is going to get addressed later today as well. But Kara asks, what does the panel think about Kony 2012? Will this movement help or hurt social activism? What do you think we're going to say?
Why is everybody looking at me?
Look, You're the one working in Africa.
I think it's a great piece of marketing, right? And I think the difficulty for me, I mean, I look at Invisible Children. I say that in a certain way, in a lot of ways, they're much more successful than Small World News has been. And so my question is, how do I learn from them doing marketing and then also build stuff, you know, also do good work? And I think too often, aid organizations, advocacy organizations, NGOs are focusing so much on the marketing and the fundraising that essentially they become a fundraising organization and not really an action organization.
But like your oh wait, I'm sorry, my mic's off. But okay, but like your comment about like seeing what they're doing and learning from it is something that anybody in business can do. Like I look at a successful company, I'm like, oh, how can I model what's good? But there's some things in Kony that is not inherently moral. People should be telling their own stories, and we should be building tools and celebrating tools that do that. So yeah, that's how I think about it.
Yeah, I think
bring
that.
It home.
It's a great marketing project, and it's raising a lot of attention. That's going to be a lot harder for Ugandans to tell a lot of those stories. The problem is, what is the actual work happening on the ground, and who is it empowering? I think Charity Water does a great job of telling an amazing story and then giving the support to the right people on the ground. Mm-hmm. Invisible Children hasn't proven that it's doing that, or it has the right advisors. It doesn't have Africans on its board. So how is it really going to make the right decisions on the ground? Right. I think that's the sad part.
And that's, I think, the biggest takeaway there, that it's about who's on the ground and not about the shiny, pretty, happy. So thank you all so much for coming. We're going to hang out here for a few minutes. Feel free to come up and talk. Thank you for braving the morning. All right.